I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another edition of the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. Lawmakers in Annapolis and Washington are wrestling with competing views on prescription drug affordability, the Children's Health Insurance Program, legislation to stem the rising tide of opioid addiction, and changes to the Affordable Care Act, among other issues. What are the feds and the state willing to do to help cities like Baltimore, who are strapped for cash and who have no shortage of people in need? And with flu season in full swing, what can you do to protect yourself and the ones you love, particularly children and the elderly, who are most at risk for a disease that can be fatal? The Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, on this blustery Friday. It is Tuesday, actually. I'm just looking ahead. It's a Freudian slip here. I'm dreaming of the weekend already. I'm Tom Hall, dreaming because of all the snow. You know, it's got me completely disoriented, but we are glad you're with us. And by all the snow, I don't really mean that. It's blustery. It's kind of snowing. It's doing a very bad job of snowing outside of the studios of WIPR, but I hope it is not snowing too much where you are. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. Plenty to talk about. There's all sorts of bills floating around Annapolis having to do with prescription drug affordability or to address the individual mandate provision of the ACA, which has been eliminated under the Republican tax reform legislation. Plus, there's lots of legislation around opioids. Dr. Wen also hosted a recent visit by Acting Secretary of Health and Human Services Eric Hargan, as well as the Surgeon General Jerome Adams. So, Dr. Wen, we'll take your calls, your questions, your comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle now at midday WIPR, not at midday Tom Hall, but at midday WIPR. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Tom Hall, WIPR. Lena Wen, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So I haven't seen you in the new year, so happy new year. And first of all, let's get a baby update. You are the proud mother, you and your husband, proud parents of a little five-month-old Eli. How's he doing?
Eli is fantastic. He is sprouting little teeth. He's rolling over. It's truly a blessing to have a baby.
That's terrific. Now, you, as a matter of fact, speaking of babies, we're just at the Baltimore City Council this morning, if your schedule has not changed since it was recently published. And you're talking about a surprising thing. There was a spike last year in the number of sleep-related infant deaths. That's surprising on some level. To what do you attribute that?
So I want to first clarify that the infant mortality in total in Baltimore City, infant mortality includes babies who die from all types of causes, including congenital malformations and many other issues. Total infant mortality decreased. Sleep-related infant death, so also known as SIDS, when babies die in their sleep, that has a slight uptick. The numbers that we're talking about, though, are small. Even one baby dying is one baby too many, and certainly I, as a new mother, I mean, it's my worst nightmare to walk into a room and find that my baby isn't breathing and has died. I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like. But the infant mortality has not gone up. In fact, infant mortality is down, but the sleep-related infant deaths has a slight uptick. And because the numbers are small, we don't know exactly what the cause is. But I will say that in many of the cases, the baby was put to sleep in an unsafe environment on a sofa with soft bedding around, where there are stuffed animals, or often co-sleeping with a parent. Those are dangerous practices. And so I applaud City Council for calling this hearing to educate everyone on the ABCDs of safe sleep, which are alone, on the back, in a crib, don't smoke, no exceptions.
Yeah. So ABCD literally, you know, alone on the back. So you don't put babies down on their stomachs, right?
That's correct.
And you don't sleep with them. I mean, it's tempting, I suppose, if the baby's crying, you want to comfort the baby and stuff. But boy, if you fall asleep and the baby falls asleep and you roll the wrong way, you can smother a baby.
I mean, that's right.
That's a terrible tragedy, but it's happened.
And culturally, there are a lot of cultures, including mine. I mean, growing up, my parents put me in the same bed as them. They put me on my belly, thinking that that was the best way to prevent a baby from, if the baby spat up, then at least they would spit outward. But that's not what science and medicine tell us to be true. Actually, the esophagus is below the trachea, the windpipe, and so putting the baby to sleep on their back is safer. And studies have shown that, as you said, that there are many cases of parents who roll over on their babies inadvertently. They're tired, they're sleep deprived. Also, there may be substance use involved. And this is why having all of us be part of the educational process is so critical.
Yeah, and the D is don't smoke. No exceptions. You know, there's,
That's right.
I mean, we've known that for a long, long time. But, you know, secondhand smoke, particularly deleterious for little ones. Yeah, that's right.
And even third-hand smoke and smoke that smoke residue that's on clothing and hair can be harmful too.
Yeah, even just the residue on the hair. Wow, that's interesting. That is interesting. Well, again, good advice. And you were talking to the folks at the city council about that this morning. Let's talk about the flu because it really is a pretty serious outbreak this year. Folks at the CDC, I mean, the information is still early because we're early in the year in the flu season, but could be as bad as it was in the 2014-15 winter, in which it was really pretty tough. There has been at least one death from the flu reported in the state of Maryland, a woman in Frederick. Where does it stand in terms of the outbreak here in the city?
We know that our hospital emergency departments, our ERs, are overcrowded. They're overcrowded because people are going into the ERs with flu or flu-like symptoms. We would urge for everyone to take the following steps. The first thing is, please, please, please get your flu shot today. There are news reports circulating saying that the flu shot this year is not as effective as previous years, which may be true. But even if it's a 20% effective rate or 30% effective rate, that still decreases the chance of having a potentially life-threatening infection by 20 or 30%. People who get the flu shot and still get the flu also are likely to have a much less severe case of the flu. So if you would have ended up in the hospital, maybe now you don't end up in the hospital. And critically, when I think about my baby can't get the flu shot because he's too young. So it's critical that I get the flu shot and others around us in the community get the flu shot to protect those like our babies and our elderly and others with chronic medical conditions who are particularly susceptible, but for whatever reason are not able to be vaccinated. So get the flu shot. Also wash your hands very well with soap and water. Flu is not the only virus going around in the winter. In fact, most of the other things that are, if you have the fever and body aches, it's more likely to be due to something else and not just influenza. Wash your hands very well with soap and water frequently. And if you do get flu-like symptoms and fever and cough and runny nose, call your doctor. Don't go to the ER. There's no need to expose other people and expose yourself.
So how does one tell the difference between the flu, influenza, and a cold? You know, if you start getting a sore throat or an earache and you start feeling badly and you've got congestion, that could be a cold. But could that also be an early indication of influenza? What is actually influenza? People use this word, the flu,
Correct. All
the time. When I was growing up, if you had the flu, it meant you had a gastrointestinal disease. It meant you were throwing up. And a cold was different. The flu meant you were throwing up. Now, the flu means you have like a really terrible cold to a certain extent.
That's right. The flu technically refers to influenza, which is a type of virus. There are many other viruses that cause flu-like symptoms. And in a way, it doesn't really matter if you have influenza and what strain of influenza you have. I mean, to us as public health officials, it matters because we track it over time, and it may also help in developing the vaccine for next year. But for an individual patient who has cold, flu-like symptoms, most important things, drink plenty of water, take Tylenol, ibuprofen as appropriate for your fever, get rest, and limit the exposure to other people. But again, wash your hands well with soap and water, stay out of the ER, and get the flu shot today. You know, I was treating patients last week, actually, in one of our urgent care centers, and there was a patient who came in who just did not want to get the flu shot. And unfortunately, there are so many myths that surround the flu shot. People think they can get the flu from the flu shot, which is not true. They think that the flu shot is not effective, and that's why they should not get it. But really, this is one, maybe 2 seconds of discomfort that can save you 2 weeks of pain. And there are people every year who die because of the flu, including others around us who we may pass it to. So I see it as our own obligation to our family members and our loved ones, as well as our obligation to society. So get your flu shot today.
Yeah, please. Our obligation to the community. We were talking about this last week with Jeff Kahn from the Berman Institute of Bioethics over at Hopkins about, you know, the obligation we have to our fellow citizens, our neighbors, because the more of us who are inoculated against the flu, or at least give it the best shot we can, you know, if it's a 30% chance, then so be it. We're 30% ahead of the game than we would have been without the shot. It protects everybody. There have been nearly 40 deaths of children to influenza this season. I think the last number I read was 37, 38 maybe. That's a lot of kids. I mean, and some of these kids were not babies. They were 13 years old. I mean, so younger people and elderly people are the most at risk, right?
And individuals who have chronic medical illnesses, for which if they get the flu, if we get the flu, maybe we can recover quite quickly. But for others, they're susceptible to dehydration. They're also susceptible to other illnesses that can come when somebody gets the flu. Because if your immune system is depressed, you're also more likely to catch other things like pneumonia that may be deadly.
410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR or @TomHall, WYPR. Let's talk, Dr. Nguyen, about another issue that you've been closely aligned with, and that is the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. You have been heralded as a leader in addressing this epidemic. The order that President Trump issued a few months ago expired about 3 weeks ago. So what does that mean? What did the order say? I know at the time there was a big kerfuffle about whether it was a national health emergency or just a mini, you know, I shall call it mini emergency, like from the Austin Powers movies. Oh, but so whatever he called it, it's expired, right? So what does that mean, and where do things stand on the federal level with the opioid epidemic moving forward?
In October, President Trump declared a state of public health emergency around opioids, which initially I was very excited about because it sounds like there are going to be federal resources committed to this epidemic. The problem is that there were only $57,000 committed in total for the entire country on this issue through the declaration. And in the last 3 months, there has been no impact for those of us on the ground. I have seen nothing as a result of this declaration. 3 weeks ago, I hosted the Acting Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Surgeon General and the head of Minority Health and the delegation from our federal partners to come to Baltimore and to learn about the work that we're doing. And I made the plea for funding directly to them. I said that we are rationing naloxone. We know people need treatment and we can get treatment ramped up really quickly. We just need the resources to do so. I was informed then that the discussion about funding was not on the table. But I said, it's my job. If I did not advocate for what we need in Baltimore City, then I'm not doing my job. So those are things that we continue to press for on the federal level. I was glad to advocate directly, not only to Congress, but also to our federal partners, to them in person. As I understand, President Trump has extended the state of emergency for another 90 days. And I sincerely hope that we will see some impact for us on the ground. But I have not received indications that that would be the case.
Yeah, calling the state emergency is all well and good. But if it doesn't actually result in anything that you can use to make, you know, to take specific action, then that doesn't do us any good, does it?
Especially because we know what works. I mean, we've been able to do so much on a shoestring budget here in Baltimore City. Actually, one of the federal counterparts said, I've never seen a dollar go so far as you have in Baltimore. Well, if that's the case, imagine how many more thousands of lives we would be able to save if we had the resources to do so. The federal government should step up, and we also hope that the state will continue to work with us in funding us for what we need. Because here in Baltimore City, we are a third of all the overdose deaths in the state. We hope that proportionally we will receive the amount of funding that is appropriate for the need and severity that exists here in the city.
Before we take a quick break, and I want to talk about some of the legislation that's floating around Annapolis during this General Assembly regarding opioid addiction and the crisis, but you issued a blanket prescription as the doctor for the city, mm-hmm. a few years ago, you issued a blanket prescription that means any of us as citizens can get naloxone. Is that right? Do I have it? Am I remembering this right? Can you explain what the blanket prescription is and how that has worked so far? Was it 2015 that you did that or 16? I can't remember.
2015. October of 2015.
So you issued a blanket prescription. Does that mean that I could go into a drugstore and
yes.
say, Dr. Nguyen is my doctor
yes.
and I want my prescription for naloxone?
Yes. So the blanket prescription essentially makes naloxone or Narcan, which is the opioid antidote, it essentially makes it over the counter. So any of our residents can walk into any pharmacy and say, I would like to get naloxone. You don't need your own prescription from your doctor. I sign one for every resident in our city. So that's the blanket prescription. The blanket prescription also critically allows our outreach workers to do street trainings and to immediately hand out naloxone right on the streets, right to people where they are.
And let's remind folks that naloxone is the drug that you issue, that you administer when someone is having an overdose in the middle of that episode, right?
Yes. If somebody has overdosed, they are unresponsive. They're not breathing. They'll die within a couple of minutes. But if they get naloxone, which is available as a nasal spray or an injection similar to an EpiPen, they will immediately be revived. Now, that is not long-term treatment for addiction. That person still needs long-term treatment in the same way that if I revived somebody with a heart attack by using a defibrillator, they still may need their heart disease and their diabetes and other things treated. But we have to save a life today.
Do you have data about how many people have had their lives saved in that crisis moment of overdosing on opioids so far in the last 3 years now?
Yes, not counting the work that's done every day by paramedics and EMTs, our first responders, but just with everyday residents. Everyday residents have saved 1,500 lives of fellow residents here in Baltimore City. And to find out more information, I encourage everyone to visit our website at don'tdie.org, www.don'tdie.org, where you can watch a brief training video if you would like. But I encourage everyone to go to the pharmacy because we should carry naloxone in our medicine cabinet and in our first aid kit. It's a public health emergency. Last year, about 700 people died in Baltimore City from overdose. We can do something about it today.
Well, 1,500 people, and that doesn't count EMTs. That doesn't count the people in the ambulances. That doesn't count
that's
the police.
Right. That's
wow,
right.
That's incredible. But and you just never know when you're going to stumble upon somebody who's got a problem with opioids. It's not limited to, you know, certain socioeconomic levels or demographics in our city. It's a problem that is widespread throughout all age groups, races, neighborhoods. It's everywhere.
I've treated children who've gotten into their parents' medicine cabinets who have overdosed. I've treated grandmothers who took too many opioids by accident because they had a knee operation. I've treated people who no colleague or family member knew that they had a heroin addiction. So we all need to save a life today.
We will come back and have more of our conversation here on the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen. She is the Commissioner of Health for the City of Baltimore. She joins me today here in Studio A, as she does quite regularly. 410-662-8780. That's our number, our email, midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR or @TomHallWYPR. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a reminder that President Trump will speak to a joint session of Congress tonight at 9 o'clock. You can hear complete coverage from NPR right here on WYPR. The Democratic response will be from Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy III. And coming up tomorrow on Midday, we'll get reaction to the State of the Union address from two veteran political reporters, Michael Barone, he's a senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner, and Christine Emba, an opinion columnist and editor at the Washington Post. Plus, we're going to speak with Shirley Bassfield Dunlap. She's a theater director who's directing the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's upcoming production of Red Velvet. It's a play about African-American actor Ira Aldridge in the 19th century and the performance that forever changed the face of theater. It's a fascinating story. I'm looking forward to that. And that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch. My guest is Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. You are welcome to join our conversation should you care to do so. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter at @MiddayWIPR. So, Lena, the governor in July of 2017 announced a $22 million allocation to fight the heroin and opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. What has happened with that, with that chunk of money since then?
Some of those funds were allocated to us here in Baltimore City, and we're grateful for our partnership with the state in that regard. Some of those funds have been used to purchase Narcan, which we desperately need and have been rationing here. So we have several more thousand units as a result of these funds. We also have additional funds that we're using to increase access to treatment. We're starting something called a hub and spokes model, similar to what Vermont has done, with the understanding that addiction treatment should be the same as treating any other disease. It should be treated in a doctor's office, in a primary care setting. Hospitals and health systems should not be able to turn away patients with addiction. We don't turn away patients with diabetes. It would be unthinkable for a primary care doctor to say, I'm not going to treat you because you have diabetes or cancer. We should do the same thing when it comes to addiction as well. And that's something that Mayor Pugh, for example, has particularly championed. Some of those funds are also going towards the funds for our stabilization center, which is the beginning of a 24/7 crisis line. Now, I understand that the governor is allocating additional funds that through a press release last week, and we hope that those funds will be allocated to areas that are the hardest hit, that have the greatest need for funding, including Baltimore City. And again, that we are a third of all the overdoses in the state. Public health principles indicate that funding and resources should go towards those areas that need it the most, because that's how we will move the needle for the rest of the state. And we hope that those funds, those new funds allocated by the governor, will go towards us in Baltimore City. We are already doing what works. We are doing the evidence-based best practices, but we can't scale them up unless we have the resources.
Speaking of having to ration Narcan, and Baltimore is one of many municipalities across the country that's had this issue because the opioid epidemic is so widespread and so serious. How do you do that? What criteria do you use to say this patient gets it and this patient doesn't?
We allocate based on a formula, an algorithm that we that the health department and our partners look at on an ongoing basis. And so we look at the individuals who are the most at risk. So none of these decisions are made at the moment of somebody's overdosing. If somebody's overdosing, we're going to save their life right now. The question is, who has access to naloxone in order to save the lives of people around them? Because if you're overdosing yourself, you're not going to save your own life. And so, for example, those who are the highest risk include the patients from our needle exchange program. These are individuals we know are currently using drugs. We're not condoning their drug use, but what we're saying is that just as we provide needles and syringes that are clean to prevent the transmission of HIV and hepatitis, we say, if we know that you're going to use drugs, please don't use drugs alone, and make sure to be trained to give Narcan and save someone else's life. We know based on our data on a needle exchange that for every 11 units of Narcan that's given out on our vans, one unit is used to save someone's life. 1 in 11. That's an incredible number needed to treat. And I think that that's why we need to really double down and get access to this critical medication.
The governor also announced his priorities for addressing the opioid crisis for this year, for 2018. Mm-hmm. One of those initiatives includes a feasibility study that he suggested to convert part of the former Baltimore City Men's Detention Center, the jail that he closed with great fanfare a couple of years ago. He wants to convert it, perhaps, or study the feasibility of converting it into a therapeutic detention facility. So therapeutic detention facility. What do you think of that idea?
While I applaud the governor for looking at the issue of substance addiction among our populations in incarceration, I'm concerned because I don't know why we don't treat patients now who are inmates. So as I understand, right now, patients, pre-trial, or I keep on saying patients because they, to me, they're patients, but individuals pre-trial who are on methadone can stay on methadone, but if they're on buprenorphine, which is another, there are three FDA-approved medications for substance use disorders, they are forced to switch to methadone. And post-trial, no matter what, there's no treatment given to individuals who require medications and require treatment. That's something that can be done right now. The governor can, and I believe should, provide all three forms of evidence-based, science-based medication-assisted treatment to every individual in our prisons and jails who need it. We don't need a separate facility to do that. We don't say, well, somebody has asthma, so they need to go to another facility. You don't bring patients to the medication. You bring the medication to the patient. I also don't understand why we need a feasibility study. We know this is feasible. In fact, this is the national best practice. I'm not sure why we need another study to do what we know is the right thing to do medically and scientifically, and where there is a huge, huge unmet need here in our city and across the state.
At the moment, five different counties here in Maryland are in lawsuits against various pharmaceutical companies about the costs of managing this opioid epidemic. So people are suing people left and right. You mentioned, the need to ration Narcan or naloxone, the antidote for an opioid overdose. To what extent is the cost of the individual dose a part of the problem? Is that the whole problem? I mean, could we? Is there a way that on the state level we can drive down the cost of this medication to the city and to the state as a whole?
It's a great question, and it's one that I asked our federal legislators, because there are two ways of making sure that we don't ration Narcan anymore. One is for the federal government or state government to just give us a lot of money to purchase Narcan. The second is for the federal government, and it has to be federal because of this is an issue faced by all of our states for the maximal purchasing power. But the federal government can negotiate directly with the manufacturers for naloxone and get us a much discounted rate. Either of those things work. I don't care. I mean, how we get there doesn't matter to me as much as the fact that I have patients dying right now and I should not be rationing this critical medication. And as to the issue of Big Pharma and lawsuits, I mean, Big Pharma is absolutely complicit in how we got to where we are. They need to be part of the solution in terms of paying restitution, but we also need for the federal government, state government, but in particular the federal government, to also take ownership. I champion to our federal representatives, as I would now, a type of program similar to what we have for Ryan White for HIV/AIDS. We need a similar level of commitment, because the number of people dying from overdose is comparable to the number of people dying from HIV/AIDS at the peak of the epidemic.
We have a couple of tweets, one from Johanna, who says, in Ontario, naloxone is available at no cost in pharmacies or public health departments. So the Canadian government has decided that just need to make this available to everybody for free under their healthcare system. Alicia writes in on Twitter, as someone on the front lines of pain, our area's biggest problem is heroin epidemic and poor access to pain management. We have to jump through hoops to prove our pain, and most times it's not even enough. Again, this is always part of the conversation for people who are on opioids for chronic pain or for acute pain following a particular procedure. You don't want them lost in the shuffle.
Correct.
On the other hand, it's very tricky business to treat a patient with pain medication without having that patient end up addicted.
It is a tricky issue. And the last thing that I would want to do is to punish those individuals who legitimately need pain medications for chronic pain or for acute pain, because there are appropriate uses of opioids. But we also know that the pendulum has swung far in the opposite direction, where every year there are enough prescriptions for opioids written that every adult American can have their own bottle. That's 230 million prescriptions for opioids written. We have gone far in the other direction, and we need a lot more education of our doctors, including of alternative pain therapies. So I encourage every patient, if you are going to your doctor, or if you're the family member of somebody going to their doctor and you're getting prescription opioids, ask, do I really need this? What are the alternatives? Is there something else that I can take? What are the side effects? These are questions that we should all be asking to be better advocates for health.
And there are even things outside of Western medicine that people point to, acupuncture or massage or, you know, stress release therapy and stuff. There's all sorts of stuff. But boy, it's a complicated thing. David in Pikesville, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
I'd just like to know if you have any statistics on how many people purposely overdose on opioids to commit suicide.
That's an interesting question. Thanks for the call, David. Is there any evidence that there are a lot of people purposely, you know, committing suicide via heroin or an opioid overdose?
Well, it's hard to answer the question because we don't always know the motivations of individuals who die. I will say that from our understanding and our studies of people who have non-fatal overdoses, meaning they overdose, but they are rescued in time. Maybe they were rescued by a paramedic or by a family member. The vast, 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 vast majority are accidental overdoses, especially now because there is fentanyl, which is a very strong opioid, many times stronger than heroin. Fentanyl is now being mixed in with heroin. It's being mixed in with other opioids. People who are taking heroin don't know that they are actually taking fentanyl. So they're overdosing and they're dying. And that's accidental, not purposeful.
Maryland Department of Health has released a couple of preliminary statistics about opioid deaths in the state. 2017, the preliminary numbers show that about 1,500 people died from opioid overdoses in 17. In 2016, that's up from 1,300 or so. So this is a problem that's not abating. Delegate Eric Bromwell, who's a Democrat from Baltimore County in the Maryland General Assembly, chairs the House's opioid workshop or work group. Minority Leader Nick Kipke is part of that as well. That committee has melded nearly 30 bills, 30 different bills on opioids. What should opioid legislation in this year's assembly, from your perspective, look like?
I'm glad that there is so much interest in addressing this issue. There are three things that I hope our legislators will take on. First and foremost is funding. We have to address this issue because we know what works and we need the funding to get there. So what type of funding and how it's going to be allocated is really important. And I hope that funding will be directly allocated to jurisdictions, including Baltimore City, that are the hardest hit. The second is medication-assisted treatment in our jails and prisons. This is a no-brainer. This is being done in other parts of the country. Rhode Island, for example, has all three forms of medication-assisted treatment available. Why don't we have it here? The third is crisis services and funding for a crisis center. Individuals experiencing mental health addiction issues, we don't treat them the same way that we treat individuals with a physical health emergency. So having crisis outreach teams that are 24/7, as well as crisis centers for individuals similar to what we have for any physical health issues, is really important. And so I hope that the legislature will take on funding, prison reentry, and crisis services as part of their legislative.
And the crisis services for these patients would be an alternative to going to the emergency room, for example.
That's right. That's right. And they are we're starting something like that in Baltimore City, which is the stabilization center. But we need far more funding and sustained funding for centers like this that are a 24/7 addiction mental health center, a no round door area for treatment.
Before we take a break, let's go to Greg in Catonsville on the phone. Greg, you've been very patient. Thanks for that patience, and welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Dr. Nguyen, and Tom, I appreciate you taking my call. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
It's funny. You had the show last week on flu, and my wife actually started working in Johns Hopkins and was required to get the shot. And I thought, yeah, I got to get that shot. Then I got the flu. And I'm coming off the flu right now. And what, you know, my sister-in-law, who also works at Johns Hopkins, was nice enough to tell my wife, oh, yeah, you got to watch it. You know, men over 50 are prone to heart attacks right after they get the flu.
All right, well, let's take that. Let's give that question to Dr. Nguyen. Is that true? Men over 50 are prone to heart attacks if they get the flu shot?
That is not my understanding. The best recommendation that I offer is what the National Centers for Disease Control Prevention offers, which is that everyone should get the flu unless you cannot get the, or everyone should get the flu shot. Everybody should not get the flu, but everyone should get the flu shot unless there is a reason why you cannot. For example, if you are a young baby, if you have someone with a particular medical condition and you're immunocompromised, Greg should still get the flu shot, even if he thinks he had the flu. First of all, because he may not have actually had influenza. He may have had a cold or some other virus that caused flu-like symptoms. And also because there are multiple strains of the flu. And so we should all get the flu shot.
But there are certain, if Greg or someone else has a heart condition, a pre-existing heart condition, or diabetes, or, cancer located in some particular place. I mean, there are people who are there people who in fact do not qualify or cannot be administered a flu shot?
There are very few individuals who should not get the flu shot. If you have a concern about whether you are one of those individuals, call your doctor and ask. But the issue that I see far more often is people who say they heard a particular myth or misconception about the flu shot, but actually they should be getting it. They will benefit from it as well, their loved ones and people around them.
One more question about the flu, then we're going to take a break and we're going to switch to some other subjects. If you have the flu, if you're like Greg, who doesn't sound all that great, and we hope that you feel better soon, Greg, if you're hacking away and you've got the flu, is it at that moment too late to get the flu shot? Can you still get it then when you are in the middle of dealing with the disease?
Best to ask your doctor about the timing, because I don't think it's necessarily the best idea to go into a doctor's office while you're actively infectious just to get the flu shot. But it's still a good idea at this point in time, because we're still in flu season right now.
Yeah, flu season ain't over by any means, and it won't be over for several more weeks. Okay, well, let's take a little break. Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. We'll have more of the Midday Health Watch when we return. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR. Now back to Midday.
Welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Lena Nguyen. She is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore, and she joins us regularly for the Midday Health Watch. By the way, last month, Dr. Nguyen was honored by Governing Magazine as one of 9 public officials of the year. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I hadn't heard about that until this morning, because it wasn't published in the only magazines I read, which are Mad Magazine and National Lampoon. It just wasn't in there. They didn't get the press release, but congratulations. Official of the year right here in Studio A, welcoming your phone calls and questions and comments and emails and tweets and that kind of stuff. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter now, @midday WIPR. So you were at the Women's March a week or so ago, a couple weeks ago. One of the things you talked about was the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, took a big hit in the Republican tax reform plan, which passed right before Christmas, because it eliminates the individual mandate. So it's no longer, you are no longer penalized if you choose, for whatever reason, not to have health insurance. You talked about that and a number of other issues. What was your experience at the march? And talk about the state's efforts. These are two different questions, but the state's efforts, because there are a number of Maryland lawmakers, Jim Rosapep from College Park, Brian Feldman, a couple of others who are trying to come up with some legislation that would impose the mandate for Maryland residents to try to maintain it on the notion that without maintaining it, the pool of people buying health insurance is going to end up being pretty sick, and that's going to raise the rates for everybody.
Sure. So regarding the march, I was very glad to go, and I spoke and I went for 3 reasons. The first is I marched as a doctor, because I've seen what happens when my patients don't have access to health insurance. I mean, I practiced medicine before and after the Affordable Care Act. And I talked about, for example, a patient of mine who was 28 and had a pre-existing condition, which was she was born with a congenital heart issue. She couldn't take her medications. When she turned 26, she was priced out of the ability to pay for insurance, priced out of her parents' plan, and ended up dying because she just could not pay for health insurance. So I marched and spoke because healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. And I also spoke as an immigrant because my family was lucky to be here. I mean, I'm lucky I came when I was 8. I'm lucky to be here because of our country's policies that allowed us to get political asylum. And I don't know where I would be if our policies were different, but I definitely would not be here as the health commissioner. And finally, I spoke as a new mother. I don't want my son growing up in this society that denies science, that seems to embrace racism and misogyny and homophobia and all these things that we know are just wrong. And so I wanted to join in solidarity with others to speak up and to fight and to do what we can right now in our communities, even in light of all the other things that are happening around us. And so to your question about what we can do in the state, I think there is a lot that I would urge the legislature to do. I think it is important for us to have legislation to enforce the individual mandate. But I think we have to go a lot further in protecting the Affordable Care Act and and also in expanding health insurance. For example, we can expand Medicaid and Medicare. Legislation can be introduced to allow for buy-in for people who currently do not qualify under particular limits. I mean, it could be an earlier buy-in for Medicare. It could be a higher income level for Medicaid. We can also have a public option that would also increase the likelihood of affordability of health insurance, too. And ultimately, I think we have to remember that there's a lot happening on the federal level that we may not be able to change right now, but there's a lot that we can do here in Maryland and here in Baltimore City, and that requires all of our efforts.
Of course, there is a gubernatorial election and elections for members of Congress and county executives coming up in June. The primary is June 26th, the election next November. I will be talking to everybody running in the Democratic race for governor for the chance to oppose Larry Hogan in the general election. And I'm sure all of them are going to have some ideas about what the state can do given the Trump administration's antipathy towards the ACA. So we will have those conversations. They're going to start in just a couple of weeks. We're going to talk to everybody running for county executive and the contiguous counties around here and that kind of stuff. So stay tuned to Midday. Let's try to sneak in a couple of other calls. Meg in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you for advocating for drug treatment in the detention center and for incarcerated persons. And I was hoping also that while you're at it, you could encourage the system to allow people who are pregnant in the detention center to take prenatal vitamins, which they currently don't do. And it seems like such a no-brainer since we know the benefits of having people taking prenatal vitamins, especially if they're not getting a wonderful diet, which they're not in the detention center.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Meg. I appreciate it. So prenatal vitamins.
I actually was not aware of this issue that pregnant women are not taking prenatal vitamins while in detention, and I will be following up with the state about this issue.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. Rick in Severna Park, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question. Does naloxone work if you've ingested, however, too much fentanyl? Will that also, like, neutralize that?
That's a good question, Rick. Thanks for the call. So you mentioned about the prevalence of fentanyl, carfentanil, and it's mixed in with heroin. So
yes.
There are people addicted to heroin who are shooting heroin thinking that it's heroin and it's not. It's got fentanyl. Does naloxone work as an antidote to that?
Yes. There are many different types of opioids. Fentanyl is a type of opioid. Heroin is a type of opioid. Oxycodone, Oxycontin, they're all types of opioids. Naloxone works on all of them because it blocks the receptors in the brain that opioids would otherwise bind to. And so it is absolutely effective for all these opioids. The difficulty with fentanyl is that it's much stronger than the other forms of opioids that are normally available, and therefore it often takes multiple doses of naloxone, which is another reason why we need access to this life-saving medication at this time of an epidemic, which we have not even seen the peak of. It's terrifying. As you mentioned, Tom, the numbers are increasing. We have not even seen the peak of this epidemic yet.
We have a call from a doctor who identifies himself as or herself as Dr. Burke, not on the line, but has a comment about a caller we got in the second segment here about the likelihood of a heart attack if you've gotten the flu shot. And Dr. Burke says the data shows that men over 50 are 6 times more likely to have heart attacks when they get the flu, not the flu shot. So Greg's sister-in-law sort of had heard something somewhere and didn't quite get it right. So if you've gotten the flu, then perhaps your chances of a heart attack increase a little bit, according to Dr. Burke's understanding of the research. Have you heard anything about that?
If that's true, then that's even more reason for everyone to get the flu shot, including men who may be at risk of a heart attack. But I mean, I can see how conceivably something like this would be true, because having the flu or having any other illness decreases one's immune response and potentially makes us susceptible to other illnesses. It may make our heart beat faster and therefore increase the likelihood of other illnesses. So again, anything we can do to prevent, including getting the flu shot, something as simple as getting a 2-second pinch in the skin, is something that we should do for ourselves and our loved ones.
All the more reason to get the shot then. Let's grab one more call if we can. Bill in Chestertown, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Yes, I had a comment on oxycodone. I had a hip fracture about 6 months ago and was sent to a rehab place for 21 days. It was run by the University of Maryland. And they sent me home with enough oxycodone to start my own store.
Did you take it? No.
Mm-hmm. I took what I needed while I was in the hospital, in the rehab, but then they sent me home with a ton of it, which I didn't need and didn't want, but they wanted me to have it.
How's your hip feeling now, Bill?
Well, I had to have another surgery. It was a problem in the original operation, so I'm sorry to hear that.
All right, well, best of luck. I hope you're feeling better.
On this last operation, they gave me none. So it just amazes me that a facility run by the University of Maryland would send me home with that much.
Yeah, of course, University of Maryland, Dr. Nguyen, not the only facility prescribing those kinds of opioids. I mean, this is you just mentioned this. This is a thing that doctors need some advice about this. They need some further education.
And we've been working with doctors in the city and hospitals as an attempt to change medical culture. The culture also needs to change with patients and consumers as well. We cannot have this pill for every pain culture where patients come in expecting for their pain to go away. But if you fall down and you sprain your knee, maybe a little bit of pain is okay. Maybe the goal is not to be pain-free, but to be comfortable and to get better. I would also urge for Bill and for others who have opioids, if you got too many opioids first, you can refuse them. You can say to your doctor, I don't need it. Can I have something else? But if you happen to see opioids in your medicine cabinet, you can go to our 9 police precinct districts 24/7. There are safe disposal boxes for any medications, anytime, no questions asked.
Yeah, because it's not the kind of thing you want to just dump in the trash, right? You don't want this stuff ending up in landfills or wherever. I mean, you do want to dispose of it safely, too. So go to the police stations. That's the best place to dump them.
That's right. You do not want for family members and little kids and other people to accidentally get into pill boxes. Mm-hmm. They could overdose and die.
It's a definite danger. Okay, well, that's all the time we have. Dr. Nguyen, it's always good to see you and give our best to Eli and give him a kiss from me.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore and the mother of Eli. We've got links to the Baltimore City Health Department on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. President Trump's first State of the Union address begins at 9 o'clock tonight. We'll have complete coverage of Mr. Trump's speech and the Democratic response, which will be delivered by Massachusetts Representative Joe Kennedy III. He's a grandson of the late Robert F. Kennedy. and he is considered by many as a rising star in the Democratic Party. Tomorrow on Midday, we'll have reaction to the State of the Union from Michael Barone, a senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner, and Christine Emba, an opinion columnist and editor at the Washington Post. We'll also speak with Shirley Bassfield Dunlap, who's directing the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's new production of Red Velvet. It's a play about the 19th century African-American actor Ira Aldridge and his legendary performance of Othello. That's going to be a fun story to learn about. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Stay tuned for Out of the Blocks with Aaron Henkin. That's coming up after the NPR newscast at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.